And we'll look at this chapter 3. That's where we've got to. We're thinking about this practical letter of Paul. And tonight we call the passage Growing in Faith. We had it read earlier, and maybe what I can do now is just simply to read one sentence from the passage, and I want to focus on verse 8. For now we live, if you stand fast in the Lord. They were standing fast. That was the amazement to the Apostle Paul. Only a few weeks earlier, he'd been in Thessalonica and had had an electric 3-week mission there. And then he'd been turfed out by the religious authorities. They got him out, and some of the zealots got him out of the way as well. They didn't want to hear this preaching. And he left there a little bunch of Christians, very new, hardly knew anything. And Paul had to travel on to other places, Berea, Athens, Corinth, and all the time he was thinking, what's happened to them? What's happened to them? How did the mission go? How are those new Christians, the first Christians in all of Europe? He didn't know. Then he got the news from Timothy, they're okay. They're all right. They're holding on. The church is like the mint that we used to grow in our garden when we lived in Essex. Some idiot put in some mint into the garden just outside the kitchen window. And I thought for a while it would be all right. Then it spread and spread, and then it began to get out of control. It spread all over the place. And I, as the intrepid gardener, it's my job to control the mint. So I poured Weedol. That was my first thing. Weedol, I remember it was called. And it kept it down for a bit. And then 3 weeks later, it was getting even spreading even better than ever. And then I poured petrol and set fire to it. I thought that was it. But no, I hadn't done it. Weeks later, it was still growing away. I didn't like digging anyway. I didn't like that. Nothing I did except digging could deal with the mint. And even when I dug, still it would escape me. And the church is a bit like that. You can try and drench it with persecution. It somehow goes on growing. I don't mean that in a triumphalistic sense. Too easily people say the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. We shouldn't talk like that, not at least in a glib way, because we shed tears when we hear of murders happening in different parts of the world. Nevertheless, the church is like our mint. There seems to be something in it which helps it to hold on. And this passage here introduces us to the heartache of a Christian leader and pastor as he worried about the infant church and as he expresses some of his concerns and worries about them. The relationship of the apostle to the young church of Thessalonica wasn't unlike the relationship between a tennis coach and a tennis player. I know that because we have had a tennis player staying with us in our house from the last week, playing in the Queen's tournament. We also had his coach staying with us. And, of course, to support the player, I went along on one of those days to watch the player. But I also kept my eye warily on the coach. So while the player was unleashing his serves at Kevin Curran, I also kept close to the coach, who wasn't on top of the player, not at the court side. He stood a little bit back, a little bit detached, watching, supporting, analyzing, observing. And so every now and then he would say to me, well, that was a great serve. Oh, I said, why was that a great serve? It looked like a three-quarter pace serve. Well, he said it was great because he served it deliberately right into the corner, deep, followed it, did it with three-quarter pace, as you say. That gave him time to get up to the net. And also, he said, he confused Kevin Curran by serving it at three-quarter pace. He said it was a very smart move, that. So I thought, that's interesting. And then at other moments, you'd hear the coach saying, oh, trouble, trouble, trouble. So it'd be suddenly a game point or set point. Oh, you'd hear him say it several times, trouble, trouble. Maybe Paul felt that way a bit when he was the coach, so to speak, to the Thessalonians. At certain moments, he'd be saying, oh, trouble, trouble. We've been thrown out of Thessalonica. The Jews have turned us away. And wherever we go, we find our path blocked. Can't get back to Thessalonica. Trouble, trouble. How are they getting on? And so here, when you look at verse 8, now we live if you stand fast, says the apostle. He meant by that that he felt encouraged. He felt that life could be lived again once he got good news of the Thessalonian Christians, only weeks old in the faith. So here in this passage, we find the ache of an apostle and a pastor for those young Christians. And it's first partly the ache of separation. The ache of separation. He's now far from them, miles away. You can see that ache in last week's passage in chapter 2, verse 17. But since we were bereft of you, brethren, for a short time, in person, not in heart, we endeavored the more eagerly and with great desire to see you face to face, because we wanted to come to you. I, Paul, again and again, but Satan hindered us. Something had got in the way. Something had made it difficult. And he puts it down to the evil one who was at work, putting in obstacles and blockades. And he feels it, the ache of separation from those young Christians. When you want to read the background passage to this story, you read later on at your leisure, Acts chapter 17, verses 1 to 15, where this tremendous mission to Thessalonica is described. How these new Christians began, then how the opposition forced Paul and his companions to flee the city, leaving the little church struggling. And he felt this, separated from those young Christians. How are they getting on? How had the centerpiece of Mission Europe fared? Was Mission Europe a flop? Because that was the centerpiece of it. Or had it been a success? He didn't know, and he felt the ache of it. 3 weeks only he'd spent there in Thessalonica. And that was a city that spanned the west-east route that linked the Adriatic in western Greece right through to Constantinople and then on to Asia Minor, a key route for the whole of Europe. And Thessalonica was right in the middle of it. This all happened about AD 50. You read about it in Acts 17, how Paul was then ejected, had to go on to Berea, then Athens, then Corinth. And so a question mark is hanging over the success of the whole enterprise. And Paul describes what it felt like as he writes this letter back to Thessalonica a little later. Not much later, only weeks later. Therefore, verse 1, when we could bear it no longer, we were willing to be left behind at Athens alone, and we sent Timothy, our brother and God's servant in the gospel of Christ, to establish you in your faith and to exhort you. Special envoy, Timothy, is sent from where Paul is to go and find out what's happening to those young Christians and then to give them a helping hand. And Paul says, I don't mind. I'm willing to be left alone at Athens. We were willing to be left, verse 1. I looked at the Greek word for left, and it's used in Matthew 19, verse 5, when it says that a man shall leave his father and mother. Irrevocable. That's what it's talking about. Rather definite. Luke 15, verse 4, the same word is used about the shepherd. Will he not leave the 99 sheep in the wilderness and go after the one sheep which is lost? Abandonment, isolation, that's the idea that comes through. We were willing to be isolated, he says. I was. It's the royal we, Paul is really using of himself. Willing to be there in a vacuum with nothing happening, alone, in Athens, a foreign, alien place. Have you been alone in a city? Somebody here probably has felt the loneliness of London. Find yourself alone, friendless, without guides, without resources. It happens frequently. Or you've been in some other city, in another part of the world. You say, I'm alone. I don't want to be alone. Paul said, I was willing for that to happen in order that these young Christians could have a visitation from Timothy, my envoy, to find out what's happening. And so, hot foot, he's sent off there. Let's not waste another day, says Paul. Timothy, you go. And Timothy was the one to go because Silas and Paul had already been in trouble, already been in prison. The authorities knew them already, but Timothy was the unknown one. He could slip in over the border. No one knew Timothy. He was the envoy. And then look at verse 6, would you? But now he says that Timothy has come to us from you. Timothy has come back and has brought the good news of your faith and love and reported that you always remember us kindly and long to see us. So there was wonderful news that came back, and you can feel the relief washing over the apostle as he learns this wonderful, wonderful news that Mission Europe is unscathed, But the young Christians are all right there in Thessalonica. And so he says, we're going to send a letter at once. Here is the letter. We're reading it now, tonight. Amazing that it's been preserved for us to see. So he sends the letter at once. Don't let's keep them waiting another day before we send them our encouragement now as well. And so he wrote the letter. We live if you stand fast. It's good news. It's our bread and butter. It's our meat and drink to know that you young Christians are all right, he is saying in the letter. But you can feel here the ache of separation. Then there's the ache of responsibility. That's here too. Look at verse 2 once again. We sent Timothy. Why was Timothy sent? It says here, the word is used to establish you in your faith. It isn't enough, you see, quite honestly, to have somebody who says, I made a decision for Jesus Christ umpteen years ago. Sometimes you meet somebody and you say, you know, how are you getting on in the life of the church? Well, not much at the moment, but I did once go forward at Billy Graham, you know, or some other mission. It's not enough that, as Billy Graham and his team are always concentrating on the follow-up, aren't they? Because it's vital. So does Paul here. It's not enough to say there's a bunch of new Christians. They've got to grow and confirm the fact that they are Christians by growing. Life is not lived by standing still, said Max Warren. So if there's somebody here, you've been a believer 1 week, 3 weeks, I don't know how long, you will find in a year's time, much as just when we interviewed Lorraine Webster a moment ago, that God will have helped you to grow through fellowship, reading of the Bible, through being in the worship just week by week, growing quietly and steadily. Little by little, God leads us, builds up our characters, makes us more like Jesus Christ. That's the objective, to be more like him and to be growing in love for his church. The ache of responsibility, that's what Paul wanted to happen. He was aware that it wasn't easy. Verse 3 and 4 heighten the fact of the afflictions that came, the difficulties. He didn't want that church to be moved. It's the only time that word moved there is used in the whole of the New Testament. And I think it has the idea of tail wagging of a dog that is wheedling its way up to you and trying to entice you to play ball with it or whatever it may be. To be moved in that way, to be enticed away by these afflictions or whatever they may be, the adversities, the opposition. And he says, you yourselves know that this is to be our lot. He had taught them in that three-week mission. He had said, obviously, to them, affliction, adversity, trouble is going to be part of your lot as a Christian. He'd warned them and prepared them. He says so in verse 4. We told you beforehand that we were to suffer afflictions, just as it now has come to pass, and as you know. There's the ache of responsibility there. These Christians were going to have a period of collision with other beliefs and with the authorities as well. And so verse 5, you can feel the anxiety of the pastor once again betraying itself. For this reason, when I could bear it no longer, I sent that I might know your faith for fear that somehow the tempter had tempted you and our labor would be in vain. Paul feels that acutely. He realizes very well that he's the apostle to the Gentiles, as well as to the Jews, and he's out there in Europe, the spearhead. He feels the crushing responsibility of it. But then you and I feel that. People here, some people here will be a fellowship group leader. Do you not feel the responsibility of having a bunch of fellow Christians and that your job is to be like a kind of pastor to them, praying for them regularly and just making sure that the team coheres and that the studies are going to be satisfactory evenings and the times when you eat together, that it'll be really happy and helpful times. Don't we feel the responsibility when one of the group is taken ill, goes to hospital? We all feel it then. The ache of responsibility, we do feel that. Paul felt it so strongly and acutely. He says in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 28, and apart from other things, there is the daily pressure upon me of my anxiety for all the churches. He goes on, "Who is weak and I am not weak? Who is made to fall and I am not indignant?" We feel it if we've been given some kind of responsibility by God. We feel it when one of our charges comes under difficulty or opposition or falls away in some strange way. We feel angry about it and we long to help. It is part of this strange ache, not only just of separation, the ache of responsibility devolving upon God's servant. So when God gives you and me somebody to look after, spiritually, we feel this ache, this holy anxiety on their behalf. We see a younger Christian friend maybe falling into strange errors of teaching, and it just kills us to see it happen. And frequently, we can do nothing about it, except to be on hand to pick up the pieces afterwards. I've known dear Christian friends who, simply because of their ignorance, would pick up any old book purporting to lead them into truth, and then go right down some hopeless blind alley, a dead end, with the nerve and the vitality cut out of their character and their Christian living as a result. And because we were perhaps their mentor, their older helper, we feel responsible. We ache with it. It was this that made the Apostle Paul ache for his younger Christian friends. He was to feel this most acutely of all, of course, at Corinth, which was such a muddled church. And later on, you remember when those false apostles arose in the midst of the infant church, discrediting Paul and promoting themselves, with the young believers swallowing the bait, hook, line, and sinker. We read in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 12 to 15, how Satan could disguise himself as an angel of light, the devil with a dog collar, that sort of idea. Highly spiritual, even super spiritual, in disguise. Ah, trouble, trouble. Paul felt it as the coach, terribly. It's Paul's anxiety of verse 5. He entertains what he calls this fear, as he puts it, for fear that somehow the tempter had tempted you and our labor would be in vain. For whom do we feel responsible? Christians here, and I know not everybody here is a Christian. Most of us are. Those of us who are, for whom do we feel responsible? God has given perhaps somebody to you. Don't know who. Somebody to look after. Somebody to steer towards stability. And you're holding on to them like a leech in your prayers, if not physically. At least you're with them, you're encouraging them, just as Lorraine Webster told us how that it was friends who brought her to that invitation service 2.5 years ago. Who did that for you? Did somebody do it for you? Who are you doing it for? Who are we trying to help? Who has God given us to be pastor, mentor to? Our difficulty is that we live in a privatized world where the laissez-faire attitude is in the ascendancy, where everybody can do their own thing, go to their own place, and you do your own thing, you go to your own place. It's private, no need to interfere in other people's lives. But then if that principle had operated in our case, would you and I be Christians today? If nobody had cared for us, befriended us for Christ's sake, put themselves out for us, concerned themselves for the welfare of our soul, where would we be? So there ought to be this kind of God-given ache in the heart of the Christian who is learning this sense of responsibility for that brother, that sister Christian. Paul experienced it, the ache of separation and the ache of responsibility. Lastly, the ache of affection. That's here too. The ache of the pastor, and it's the ache of affection for those Christians. Look at verse 6 again. "Now that Timothy has come to us from you and has brought us the good news of your faith and love, and reported that you always remember us kindly and long to see us, as we long to see you." And so he goes on in that affectionate vein, speaking to those young Christians through this letter that we're reading tonight. The ache of affection. How extraordinary, Mr. Preacher, you say. They'd only known Paul 3 weeks, been there 3 weeks in Thessalonica, and Already they're remembering him kindly. They couldn't forget. I think it's Christianity that does that. That mission had created a bond between leader and learners that was to be permanent. It's funny they were able to say to each other, but it seems as though we've known Paul all our lives. We've known that situation. We come into a situation where we meet with fellow believers, perhaps at last, when we've been isolated. We say, it's wonderful to know them. There's a link that's created. You who are in beginners groups here, I'm sure that in later years you will not forget the name of the beginners group leader. You'll probably find that you have forged a prayer link with them in days to come. I bet you will. I remember the Enterprise when I, as a young person, became a Christian in my heart for the first time. Years ago, and the person who was in charge of our group was a man called Timothy Dudley Smith. We often sing his songs and hymns in church and in our worship. He hadn't written any by that stage. He was just a young student, really. And I always look back to that, and I'm sometimes proud. I told him the other day, I say, sometimes when I announce one of your hymns, Tim, I say, he was my dorm officer. He said, I hope you don't say that every time. Well, I say, just occasionally. I like to say it. I like to remember the bond. Tim Dudley Smith helped me. He's a bishop now in Thetford. There's a bond there we've had all over the years. For now we live, if you stand fast. That's what happens. There's a bond, a current, between the person who helped you and yourself in days to come. And if you're going well, it lifts them and encourages them. They live. It's the bread and butter of it. And verses 9 and 10 illustrate this bond of affection and gratitude existing between Paul and the Thessalonian Christians. I love verses 9 and 10. For what thanksgiving can we render to God for you, he says, for all the joy which we feel for your sake before our God, praying earnestly night and day that we may see you face to face and supply what is lacking in your faith. You can feel the bond. He's saying to himself, are they holding? Are they holding? They are holding. And how can we express our thanksgiving to God? He's so grateful. There is this affection. It's the ache of affection between the Christians. And we long that that should happen, whether it's a small fellowship group or whether it's the bigger gathering like this. That there should be the bond. And sometimes when we have a baptism service here, I can feel the affection coming out from the different parts of the church towards that one individual, couple of individuals being baptized or being commissioned, as with tonight and Lorraine, the affection sending her on her way. Soren Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, in his book Fear and Trembling, once used the phrase, he said, a believer is surely a lover, yea, of all lovers, the most in love. So there is this ache. And yet, is it a painful ache? Yes and no. How can the ache be eased? The burden for all the churches be lifted that Paul felt? Prayer seems to be a great secret. It places the responsibility once again back into the hands of God and acknowledges that he's the one who can build the church, and only he in the end. So look at this prayer then, the concluding prayer of verses 11 to 13. And we'll see that even here there is a built-in assumption of God's grace and guidance compensating for the factors that caused the apostles' heart to ache. Look at verse 11. Now may our God and Father himself and our Lord Jesus direct our way to you. Paul is placing this matter of the physical separation between himself and Thessalonica back into God's hands. He said, we want to get to you. I feel the ache of separation. Prayer is the answer. We'll put it into God's hands. And if anything can annihilate this separation barrier, it will be by prayer. We'll put it into God's hands. Same with when we're directing, commissioning somebody to go overseas somewhere. We put it into God's hands. You direct them and annihilate the separation barrier. Look on at verse 12. And may the Lord make you increase and abound in love to one another and to all men as we do to you. Again, the prayer at this point concerns itself with the issue of Christian affection that so made the apostle ache for those young believers. Let that ache and that affection express itself, and supremely let it be expressed by the secret behind-the-scenes activity of prayer, so that the ache isn't simply a sentiment, but finds the proper outlet. Then look at verse 13. So that he may establish, there's the same word again, establish your hearts unblameable in holiness before our God and Father at the coming of our Lord Jesus with all his saints. Establish. It happened already in verse 2. And it was Timothy's task, of course, to help the infant church to grow and get strong. That was Timothy's task, to establish them, back in verse 2. That was the ache of responsibility. It's left to verse 13 to show us that establishing young Christians is actually God's responsibility in the end. And I quote, that he may establish your hearts. So prayer is the undergirding of every true Christian work and relationship. The ache of separation, the ache of responsibility, the ache of affection. And prayer is the expression of all those things. And it turns the ache from being a mere ache into power and effectiveness. Next week we come on to chapter 4. Let's pray. God our Father, there are times when we say to ourselves, trouble, trouble, as we look at the terrible things that can happen in the world, but also the things that can happen to our friends. There are other times when we feel the keen sense of relief as we hear of good news, of people moving on and being intact against the inroads of worldliness or error. God our Father, help us to look after each other in this church family. Help us to keep our eyes open for the stranger who comes in among us, feeling alone and buffeted. Help us to keep a look out for our friends too, that we may cover each other carefully and guard each other in prayer. And we thank you for the encouragement of Thessalonica. In Jesus Christ's name, amen.